Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by Boston University's African Studies Department titled Local Perspectives on the Sudanese Conflict. Speaking will be Professor Ahmed Sakanga, former Fulbright Scholar in Morocco and Mellon Fellow at Harvard University. We begin with an introduction from James Pritchett, Associate Professor of Anthropology, Director of Boston University's African Studies Center, and Associate Provost for Intra-University Programs.
Our guest today, Ahmed Alawad Sakanga, comes to us complete with a very hefty CV, some of the highlights of which are, if you will allow, he received his BA with honors in history from the University of Khartoum. He received his Master's of African and Asian Studies from the University of Khartoum as well, and his PhD in history from the University of California in Santa Barbara. His major research interests are social and economic history of Africa and the Middle East, with a focus on slavery, labor, and urban history. He is currently a professor both in the Department of History and the Department of African American and African Studies at Ohio State University, as well as the director of the Center for African Studies at Ohio State University. He has taught as well at Harvard, City University of New York, North Carolina A&T, University of California, Santa Barbara, Amadou Bello University in Nigeria, Bayero University in Kano, Nigeria, and was at one point the archivist, the national archivist of Sudan. He has been the recipient of most of the major fellowships that one can receive in this country: Social Science Research Council, the American Philosophical Society, the American Council of Learned Societies, Mellon Faculty Fellowship, Social Science Research Council again, and afford research grants. But when I personally think of Ahmed Sakanga, I float toward his most recent book entitled City of Steel and Fire, A Social History of Atbara, Sudan's Railway Town, 1906 to 1904. Now, the easiest way to describe this book would be to say it's a labor history. After all, Dr. Sakanga is a noted labor historian. But I think to stop there would do a disservice both to the book and to the author. This book is not just about work and wages, labor and legislation, controls and resistance. This is a book that is rich in firsthand accounts that takes us deep into the private experiences of railway workers. It tells us about the organization of public and domestic spaces, about the recreational life of a colonial town, and about the development of social networks as well as corporate identities. This book sheds much light on the development of urban working class in an African city, as well as the role of organized labor in shaping contemporary Sudan. This book is a reminder that Sudan once had one of the most radical trade union movements in all of Africa, and that trade union movement, along with professional associations, civic organizations, actually brought down two military regimes in Sudan: that of Ibrahim Abode in 1964, and 20 years later, that of Jafar Numeri. This book, in many ways, is a celebration of the spirit of a working-class town, without being overly sappy and sentimental. It's a glorification of labor on the one hand, without necessarily being overly romantic and reductionist. It is a very well-researched, very well-presented story, clearly the work of a mature scholar, one who has indeed mastered the historian's craft. But the book, to me, is also a reminder that Sudan is a very, very big place. And I refer here not just to its geographical size. Yes, it is the largest country in Africa, but it is also a place that is perhaps unsurpassed in the complexity of its ethnic, environmental, political, and economic dynamics. Sudan is far too big to be reduced to any one single set of headlines. Yes, it is indeed the place where a two-decade-old civil war is winding down in the south. Yes, it is indeed a place where a genocidal war is heating up in the west. It is indeed one of the front lines of environmental battles about water and irrigation and cotton production. And it's also one of the new Chinese beachheads in their search for African oil. It is indeed all of these things, and yet much, much more. The title of the talk today is Local Perspectives on the Sudanese Conflict. Whose perspectives? Which conflicts? In truth, I have no idea. When I invited Dr. Sikanga to give our Morris lecture back in November, I believe it was, neither he nor I had any idea what the topic would be. But I was sure of two things. There were three things that I knew. One, that he was about to take a break from teaching and spend his winter quarter in Sudan. Two, I knew that with his deep local connections, his well-honed historical sensibilities, that he would indeed return with a story to tell. And third, I was sure that that story would be worth telling. So without further ado, I bring to you our 16th Morris Distinguished Lecture, my friend, Dr. Ahmad Alawad Sikanga.
Well, thank you, Jim, for these kind words, and thank you for inviting me to speak on this important occasion. I'm really humbled by the invitation. The subject of my talk is local perspectives on Sudanese conflicts. As you mentioned, while the world was celebrating the signing on January 9th, 2005, of the peace accord between the Sudan People's Liberation Army and the Sudanese government to end the 20-year civil war in the south, a genocidal civil war is engulfing the western region of Darfur, where thousands of people were killed and over a million were displaced in the neighboring countries. The hideous killings, rape and destruction in Darfur evoke the images of the Rwandan genocide of 1994. While the United Nations and the Western countries are hoping that the North-South agreement would be used as a blueprint to resolve Sudan's age-old conflicts, civil wars have actually spread into a center-periphery conflict that shows little signs of abating. So in addition to Darfur, there is a conflict now that is going on in the eastern, northeastern part of the country. There's also potential for war within the south itself, involving some of the factions that were not included in the recent agreement between the Sudanese government and the rebel groups. So it is more appropriate to talk about, to describe the Sudan as a site or a theater of not one but several wars that could lead to the total collapse or fragmentation of Africa's largest country. No event has riveted international attention over the past several months than the genocide in Darfur. Thanks to the foreign reporters, NGOs, and others who put Darfur genocide on our newspapers, radios, and television screens. However, with the exception of a few foreign scholars and journalists, much of the media coverage of Darfur tends to follow familiar patterns of focusing on the drama and providing little analysis. It also perpetuates all the stereotypes about Africa as a dark continent that is uniquely afflicted by ethnic and tribal conflicts. For many years, Western media has consistently presented the Sudanese war as one between an Arab-Muslim North and African-Christian South. The outbreak of the war in Darfur, in eastern Sudan, and in the Nuba Mountains rendered this rigid classification inaccurate. But it also revealed the complexities of the Sudanese conflict and the unique ways in which ethnic and cultural identities were formed. Another distortion was also the description of the conflict in Darfur as between Arabs and black Africans. In reality, there are no visible racial or religious differences between the warring parties in Darfur. Both the perpetrators of violence and their victims have lived in Darfur for many centuries. They are all Muslims and they are all black. As we shall see, these people were pitted against each other by a combination of natural factors, a long history of political and economic neglect, and a callous regime that ruled the Sudan today. Now, in order to understand the root causes of the various dimensions of the human tragedy in Darfur, we need to move away from the various essentialist readings of these historic events to examine the specific historical circumstances that produce and reproduce them. We also need to rethink our approaches for the study of conflicts in Africa. As the organizers of a recently held conference at the University of Florida have noted, much of the language we deploy about contemporary conflicts conflict systems in Africa appears to be a barely updated version of the 19th century rhetoric about tribal violence. Most of the categories we use to study wars in Africa do not adequately explain the various ways in which rebel armies conducted themselves in Africa and the extent to which they used customary codes of warfare, or the emergence of such phenomena as child soldiers, warlords, and Janjaweed. The conduct of the war in Darfur reveals a great deal about the transformation of ethnic identities, the militarization of the rural population, the role of ideology, and above all, the problem of governance in contemporary Africa. The primary goal of my presentation is to shed light first on the Sudanese conflicts and also to explore the way in which Sudanese themselves thought about it, about the war, about the peace process, and the future of the country. I'm particularly interested in the current debate among Sudanese intellectuals, activists, journalists, NGOs, and civil society groups about these issues. And I use the term local here with great caution, because the term local also should involve the local people in Darfur themselves. It's impossible, you know, given the current situation, the restrictions of the Sudanese government, to do any kind of research in Darfur. However, many of the people that I talk about are actually from Darfur, Darfur intellectuals, academics, and so on. Now, despite the severe repression of the present Islamist regime in the Sudan, these groups have been intimately involved in the crisis through various forms of political and social activities, writing, organizing workshops, lectures, conferences, and so forth. Nonetheless, their efforts and their voices have received very little attention in the West. In addition to the fact that local voices provide important insights for understanding this conflict, the issue is at the core of the debate about the production of knowledge about Africa. So let me give you a brief history of the history and the role of civil society organization in the Sudan. It is very hard to imagine that Sudan has one of the richest traditions of civil society organization and social protest movements. This troubled country once had one of the best organized and militant labor movements in Africa and the Middle East, which was closely associated with the Sudanese Communist Party, the second largest communist party in Africa after the South African Communist Party. That's until 1971. On two occasions, these groups led popular uprisings that helped overthrow military dictatorships, Ibrahim Aboud in 1964 and Jafar Nimeiri in 1985. They also remain critical of the traditional sectarian parties that dominated Sudanese politics since independence. These groups consider themselves as the purveyors of progressive and democratic change. It is not surprising that they have been systematically marginalized by both civilian and military regimes that rule the Sudan. In recent years, however, their political influence and the political influence of the trade union movement in general has diminished as a result of systematic repression and the proliferation of regional movements in different parts of the country. Civil society groups suffered the most serious setback under the present regime of the National Islamic Front. Since coming to power through a military coup in 1989, the junta embarked on a vigorous program of Islamization of Sudanese society and state, and exhibited unparalleled hostility towards trade unions, civil organizations, and intellectuals. Hundreds of trade union leaders, political activists, teachers, and students deemed secular and anti-Islamic were imprisoned, tortured, and killed. Thousands of people were purged from the civil service, the educational system, the army, the police, and were replaced by members of the Islamist movement. These developments were well documented by various human rights organizations. To escape persecution, many of these activists have left the country and went to exile in Egypt, in Europe, North America, the Middle East, and elsewhere. This had serious consequences because, in addition to the dramatic decline of the civil service and the educational system, the loss of a dynamic and experienced organizers created a huge vacuum and played a key role in the survival of the current regime. Nonetheless, a few dedicated groups have remained in the country and continue to organize under extremely and dangerous circumstances. The mounting international pressure, the civil war in the south, and the post-September 11th realities forced the Sudanese regime to retreat and make some concessions in the form of giving limited freedom of expression and political organization. As a result, many exiles who believe that opposing the regime in the external opposition is much more effective, or sorry, internal opposition is much more effective than external opposition, began to return to the country and try to establish their own independent niche. In addition to political organization, a growing number of NGOs, research centers, newspapers, magazines were established. And despite their small number and their operation under the watchful eye of the regime's security agents, these institutions created venues for expressing dissident voices as well as dealing with all issues facing the country. Indeed, there's no other issue that dominated the Sudanese political scene than the conflict in Darfur, the peace agreement between the North and the South, and the future of the country. Well before the outbreak of the crisis in Darfur, several individuals from inside and outside the Sudan warned the government against the explosive situation in that region and urged it to pay special attention to the region's grievances. Following the outbreak of the rebellion in Darfur and the tragic developments that followed, a group of political activists, academics, and journalists from different political parties, different regions, and ethnic groups met at the home of Al-Sadiq al-Mahdi, the former prime minister, to discuss the situation in Darfur. From the outset, they all agreed that the Darfur conflict is not a local or regional problem, but represents a national crisis that requires a national solution. A think tank called the Committee for Peace in Darfur was launched. Subsequently, the group held several meetings at Friedrich Building. This is an NGO that's supported by the German government, and to which it invited local administrators and former governors of Darfur province. It was concluded that the Darfur conflict was a result of a confluence of a number of environmental factors, political neglect, and ethnic politics. In collaboration with the Peace Institute and Development of Juba University, a symposium was held in July 2003, in which 12 papers were presented by academics, state and local government officials, and other experts. They dealt with such topics as regional inequalities and even development in the Sudan, ethnic conflicts in Darfur, conflict over resources, environmental degradation, ethnicity, and cultural diversity. In addition to conferences and workshops, a series of public lectures were organized in universities, social clubs, and streams of articles appeared in the daily press. While the government and its supporters continued to insist that the conflict is nothing more than a matter of law and order. The Darfur situation should also be seen as part of an ongoing regional turmoil with tragedies spilling from one part of the country to another. The persistence of regional conflicts attests to the fact that the fundamental problem from which all the Sudanese crises flow is the entrenched power structure that evolved over many centuries. It is marked by regional ethnic and economic inequalities, as well as the domination of a small group of elites from the northern part of the country. This small group of elites try to impose an Arab-Islamic identity on the rest of the population, while at the same time neglecting most of the outlying areas. To understand the various dimensions of the violence of Darfur, we need to look at how such factors as nature, ethnicity, competition over resources, and the manipulation of ethnic differences by the government were brought together in a deadly fashion. So let me begin by giving you a brief or basic information about Darfur, the land and the people. Currently, the region is divided into four administrative units: North, East, West, and Southern Darfur. The population of Darfur represents a multitude of linguistics and ethnic groups. They include non-Arabic speaking groups such as the Four, the Masalit, the Zagawa, the Tunjur, Daju, as well as Arabic speakers such as the Rizigat, Misiriya, Taisha, and so on. There is also a large number of West African immigrants, mainly Hausa Fulani, who came from West Africa over many centuries following the route, the pilgrimage route to Mecca. The long history of internal migration, mixing, and intermarriage created a remarkable fluidity, and ethnic labels became a matter of convenience. For several centuries, the most dominant group in Darfur were the four ethnic group. The four established a sultanate in the middle of the 17th century, known as the Four Kingdom, which was part of a series of Islamic kingdoms that extend from West Africa all the way to the Nile Valley. And it maintained strong diplomatic as well as commercial contacts with the states of West Africa, such as, you know, Wadai, as well as Egypt. The kingdom was overthrown in 1874 by the northern Sudanese slave trader, Zubair Pasha, and therefore was incorporated into the Turco-Egyptian domain. Turks were the ruler of the Sudan from the early 19th century until 1884, when they were overthrown by the Mahdist, an Islamic revivalist movement. And thereafter, an independent state was established in Sudan until the Anglo-Egyptian conquest at the end of the 19th century. Now, as I mentioned earlier, ecological factors and competition over resources was another major factor behind the tragedy in Darfur. This issue is part, should be seen as part of the general problem in the Savannah Belt. Since the 1970s, the Savannah Belt runs across Africa all the way from Senegal, Mali, Niger, and this area south of the Sahara, has experienced drought in the 1970s and 1980s. Crop farming is the main economic activities among more than 80% of Darfur's population. They grow millet, sorghum, and other cash crops such as groundnuts, sesame, and so forth. The production of these crops depended mainly on rainfall and land fertility, rendering the population vulnerable to climatic changes and natural disasters. It is well known that this region witnessed one of the worst famines in the mid to late 1980s. Continuous drought, desertification, and population increase led to a sharp decline in food production, particularly in the 1990s. Another important issue in the conflict in Darfur is land competition over land. The land tenure system in Darfur has evolved over several centuries. During the period of the Four Kingdoms, land ownership was based on a system known as Hakura. According to this system, each ethnic group was given a Hakura or Dar, which is regarded as the property of the whole community. The local chief was the custodian of the Dar, and he allocated it to members of the tribe for cultivation. The Dar was revered, actually, by people of Darfur. Belonging to a Dar, it becomes an important part of the person's identity. At the same time, successive rulers of Darfur allocated land to individuals such as high-ranking officials by giving them large estates from which they collect taxes from cultivators and so on. Also, the Sultan retained large plots of land called valleys, which were used in emergency situations such as natural disaster, displacement, and so forth. Now, under the British colonial rule, the land tenure system was modified to suit native administration. As in other parts of Africa, colonial officials in Darfur found it convenient to assume that local chiefs had demarcated authority over ethnic groups and jurisdictions over territory. The key to make the system of native administration work was to award territory to each dar or to a group. The paramount chiefs were allowed to allocate land rights to residents, and the system helped the British administration to rule the region with a handful of colonial officers. Now, after independence in 1956, the system of land tenure, or two developments actually, affected the system of land tenure. One was the abolition of the system of native administration. Successive post-colonial Sudanese government assumed that native administration is an archaic system, it's a legacy of the colonial rule, and therefore should be abolished, and they tried to replace it with local governments and so on. Another important development was the abolition of the land tenure system, the pre-colonial land tenure system, and that has a huge impact. It created all sorts of competitions among the people. One of the most important changes that also occurred among farmers was with the fact that, especially in northern Darfur, was the fact that they began to rely more and more on livestock, because there was a growing demand for livestock in the Middle East, in Egypt, and so on. So from the cultivator's point of view, grazing animals was much more profitable in some cases than cultivation. Now, as I mentioned earlier, a large number of Darfur population are cattle herders and nomads. And in fact, pastoral nomadism is the main way of life among many Sudanese groups, especially in the belt that extends from the White Nile all the way to Chad region. Now, the problem with Darfur nomads is that they did not own land. They were outside the system of the Hakura, or this system of land ownership. And therefore, they had to rely on a socio-geographical order that gave them customary rights to migrate and pasture their animals in areas which were dominated by farmers. As the nomads moved between the northern and the southern part of the region, specific arrangements for animal routes were made by local leaders of both groups, both nomadic groups and farmers. Animal routes were areas between farms designated for nomads to pass through during the movement from north to south or from south to north. Since the 1950s, these routes continued to facilitate the movement for nomads without serious implications. Other systems included something called Sinia or roundabout. It's a grazing area between farms and designated for the passing animals to graze and rest for hours or one day before resuming their movement. Another method was called Munazala or nomadic camp, which was a grazing area near or around the farms used by moving nomads for grazing areas within certain periods of time. These arrangements brought mutual benefits to both communities. Farmers used animal waste as land fertilizer, while the nomads used crop residue as fodder. To regulate the relationship between the farmers and nomads, successive local governments in the Sudan established certain rules to determine the times for nomadic movements to allow farmers to collect their crops. The system worked for decades until the drought of the 1980s. As a result of that, many farmers began to rely on grazing, and it became unpredictable. The time for harvesting became unpredictable. At the same time, the pastoralists were facing the effects of the drought, so they insisted on maintaining the old order, and that became a source of major clashes. Compounding the problem was the eastward movement of a group called Ambararo. This is a section of the Fulani of West Africa who kept moving from the area of Senegal, Mali, moving eastward all the way to the Red Sea. Now, as outsiders, these cattle herders were outside, did not follow the traditional arrangements of animal routes. So this, again, became a major source of conflicts. So the struggle over diminishing resources led to several clashes between pastoralists and farmers. Indeed, these conflicts were not new. According to a Sudanese scholar, about 39 ethnic conflicts occurred between 1923 and 2003. He noted that most of these occurred in the post-independence period. That's after 1956. But for many years, the pastoralists and the farmers developed several mechanisms to resolve these conflicts. These mechanisms included such practices called judia, or mediation. They also used native administration, tribal festivals, Sufi orders, intermarriage among different groups, as well as exchange of gifts. The judia in particular was an important method for preventing, managing, and resolving conflicts. When conflicts developed, volunteers from communities who are not part of the conflict would immediately step in and play the role of mediators. They were usually the elder. Over the years, the judia acquired sanctity to the extent that no member of the community would dare to defy it. Refusing the judia would subject the person to communal boycott. The practice became an integral part of the system of native administration. Another method was tribal festivals that were arranged periodically. Different groups would take part in what is called arda, or procession, during which tribal horsemen would march in front of a crowd of spectators to demonstrate their physical power and the well-being of their horses, their armaments, and their readiness to defend the community. The arda, or this ceremony, was an occasion for public entertainment and a means to deter thieves, robbers, and invaders. It also created opportunities for tribal leaders to meet to discuss outstanding issues and to solve intergroup conflicts by forming joint councils. Moreover, they fostered intermarriage across tribal boundaries. But the abolition of the system of native administration in the 1970s dealt a serious blow to these mechanisms for conflict resolution. The national government in Khartoum abolished the system of administration but did not provide a viable alternative. Instead, it simply neglected the region of Darfur and adopted a strategy of divide and rule by supporting the Arabic-speaking nomads against cultivators. In response, the villagers began to arm themselves to defend their property. Darfur also had the misfortune of neighboring three troubled African countries, Chad, Libya, and Central African Republic. Several Darfur groups live on the other side of the border in Chad. This made it very easy for people to move back and forth, particularly during the Chadian Civil War in the 1980s. Most important, the Chadian Civil War and the conflict with Libya led to the proliferation of huge quantities of firearms in the region. However, let's pause here. We can say that environmental factors, competition over resources, traditional conflicts between pastoralist and sedentary farmers, and regional wars provide a useful background for understanding communal conflicts in Darfur, but they do not explain the ongoing carnage. The current violence is no longer a conflict over meager resources. To understand it, we need to look at the ideology and the practices of successive Sudanese governments, particularly the current Islamist regime, and the way in which these practices have transformed ethnic identities and intercommunal relations in Darfur. As I mentioned earlier, the nationalist movement that led Sudan to independence in 1956 and the post-colonial Sudanese governments were dominated by Arabic-speaking elites from the central and the northern part of the country. In addition to concentrating economic development in the central parts, especially Khartoum and the Jazeera region, these elites tried to forge a national identity based on the principles of Arabism and Islam. This pattern generated a tenacious resistance in the form of regional and ethnically based movements, especially in the south, where a civil war has been raging for more than 20 years. Neglect and marginalization were also felt in Darfur, the Nuba Mountains, and in the east. Tensions between the people of Darfur and the central government emerged again in the 1980s when the military regime of Jafar Numeri tried to appoint a non-native of Darfur as the governor of the province. Darfurians rejected this appointment and insisted that he should appoint Ahmed Dereg, who is the native son of the province. The decade of the 1980s also witnessed important development that have profoundly influenced ethnic identities and communal relations in Darfur. The most important of these was the attempt of Colonel Gaddafi of Libya to create an Arab belt across the Sahelian Africa to gain control over Chad. In addition to mounting a series of military adventures in Chad, Gaddafi supported various Chadian factions who used Darfur as a rear base, pledging local farmers and cattle herders and pouring large quantities of arms into the region. Gaddafi's scheme involved recruiting and arming discontented Sahelian Arabs as well as Tuareg from as far as Niger and Mali into what came to be known as the Islamic Legion, which served to spearhead his offensive in Chad. Many of the Legion members were Arabic speakers from Darfur, who were also followers of the Mahdist sect in the Sudan. These elements opposed the Demirel's leftist regime and were living in Libya since the 1970s. But Gaddafi's hopes were dashed when the Legion forces were defeated by the Chadian army in 1988. The Legion was subsequently disbanded, but many of its members, armed and trained, have continued to embrace a supremacist Arab identity. Some of the Janjaweed leaders today who are now wreaking havoc in Darfur are among those trained in Libya at that time. Moreover, following the overthrow of Numeri's regime in the mid-1980s, many of the Mahdists who were opposing Numeri came back to Sudan. They formed what is called Arab Alliance, which again became another vehicle for supremacist ideology. According to Suleiman Hamid, this organization submitted a memorandum to Sadiq al-Mahdi, the prime minister at that time, demanding that the Arab tribes of Darfur should have at least 50% representation in the regional government. They argued that although the Arab groups in Darfur constitute 70% of the province population, they were marginalized. When the regional government was formed in 1988, members of this alliance felt that their demands were not met, and they reportedly held a secret meeting in which they vowed that they would do everything to destabilize the region and to displace the non-Arab groups. It was the ideology and the action of these groups that sowed the seed for the deep rift between Arabic-speaking and non-Arabic speakers in Darfur. Another important factor that had a profound impact on the political discourse in the Sudan was the emergence of the SPLA. Although based in the south, the SPLA itself presented itself as the defender of non-Arab groups in the whole country and called for the establishment of a secular, plural, and united Sudan. The SPLA made relentless efforts to recruit people from Darfur, the Nuba Mountain, the Upper Blue Nile, and so on. However, in Darfur, its efforts did not materialize, especially after the capture and the murder of its leader, Dawood Boulat, who himself was a member of the Islamist movement. So if ethnicity provided a common ground between the people of Darfur and the South, religion divides them because the overwhelming majority of people in Darfur are Muslims. Then in 1989, the National Islamic Front organized a military coup and overthrew the elected government of Sadiq al-Mahdi. Of all the political parties in the Sudan, the National Islamic Front is the most ardent and advocate of an Arab Islamic model. After coming to power, the new regime embarked on a grand scheme to transform Sudanese society to fit this mold. Moreover, the leaders of the Islamist movement in the Sudan, particularly Hassan Turabi, who was considered the power behind the scene until his ouster in 1999, had a much more ambitious plan. From his perspective, the new regime in the Sudan would become a nucleus from which Islamist movement would spread throughout Africa and the Middle East. In view of its geographic location and history, Darfur played a pivotal role in this scheme. Hence, the National Islamic Front made considerable efforts to recruit people from Darfur, as well as West African immigrants, such as Hausa, Fulani, and so on. Indeed, West African immigrants come from a region that had rich tradition in militant Islam. Despite their long presence in the Sudan, descendants of West Africans have always been marginalized by the dominant Arabic-speaking northern Sudanese. In addition to their devotion, their affiliation with the Islamist movement provided them with an opportunity for upward mobility. In other words, the non-Arab groups in Darfur were attracted by the concept of common citizenship on the basis of Islamic faith rather than ethnicity. But many Darfurian Islamists were disillusioned. Very few achieved high positions in the government, and the state apparatus was still controlled by a handful of Arabic-speaking Sudanese from the Nile Valley. The grievances of Westerners were voiced in a publication that appeared in the year 2000 called the Black Book. The author is anonymous, but many speculate that it was written by a group of Islamists, members of the National Islamic Front from the region of Darfur. The book detailed the region's systematic underrepresentation in national governments since independence. The Black Book caused stir throughout the Sudan and showed how the country has become polarized along racial and religious lines. Moreover, after the rise of the Islamist movement, the Arab Alliance was revived in the 1990s and became very vocal. In 1998, a new organization called Quraysh claimed that they want to voice the grievances of Arab groups in Darfur and Kordofan, the Arabic-speaking groups from the Nile Valley, who controlled power since Sudan independence. The new organization questioned the authenticity of the Arabic speakers of the Nile Valley, calling them, quote, Arabized Nubians. According to members of Quraysh, the true Arabs who should dominate the country are those in Western Sudan. They even began to talk about the grand state of Kordofan and Darfur. The civil war continues challenged by the opposition, increasing foreign pressure, particularly, as I said, after September 11th, and competition among the ruling party led to the split of the National Islamic Front. The party split into two factions. One faction was led by Turabi, the founder of the movement, the other by Bashir, the current president, and Ali Usman, the man who concluded the recent agreement with the South, who was Turabi's deputy and protege. Ali Usman Taha was described as a pragmatic, Machiavellian, a ruthless operator. Most of the army and the security agencies supported Bashir and Usman, while the students and regional Islamist movement, particularly in Darfur, supported Turabi. The split provided Bashir and that faction with an opportunity to cast himself as a moderate and to mend fences with the United States and the West, providing a great deal of support and intelligence after September 11th. He also began to take steps to sign the peace agreement with the South. The Bashir-Turabi split was immediately felt in Darfur. Many Darfurians who had joined the Islamist movement under Turabi's leadership now left the movement and decided to organize on their own. This led many people to believe that Turabi's faction is supporting one of the rebel movements today called the Justice and Equality Movement. But in a newspaper interview, Khalil Ibrahim, former member of the National Islamic Front and the founder of the Justice and Equality Movement, stated that he left the Islamist movement because he was disappointed in it, and he bitterly complained that he had always felt marginalized. He went on to stress that by remaining within the movement, he was betraying his people. Apart from calling for the establishment of a federal system in the Sudan, an equitable distribution of economic resources and political power among the various regions, the movement had no clear program. In the same interview, Khalil stated that his movement grew in response to what he called internal colonialism in Sudan, meaning the domination of Arabic-speaking elites. He declared that the movement is not racist, but represents all marginalized groups in the Sudan. The other rebel movement was called Sudan Liberation Army, appears to be more secular in its orientation. Its manifesto called for the separation of religion from politics and states that the movement strives to, quote, create a unified democratic Sudan on a new basis of equality, complete restructuring and devolution of power, even development, cultural and political pluralism, and moral and material prosperity for all Sudanese. But also the manifesto stated that unity should be on a voluntary basis and the right of self-determination should be maintained. It condemned Khartoum by engineering the divisions between Arabs and non-Arab groups in Darfur. And also the movement joined the National Democratic Alliance, which is an umbrella organization for all the opposition forces. The most horrific event that marked the beginning of the violence in Darfur occurred in April 2003, when the rebels attacked Al-Fashir Airport, the capital of Darfur, and destroyed military equipment and overwhelmed the Sudanese army. The initial success took everyone by surprise, including the leaders of the regime. However, from the beginning, the government dismissed the rebel movement, describing them as nothing more than a band of armed robbers. With the army overstretched, the government resorted to its unscrupulous tactics, which it used in the south and in the Nuba Mountain. These tactics include the exploitation of ethnic differences and the recruitment and arming of local militia. In Darfur, this involved the recruitment of the remnants of the Islamic Legion, who formed the core of the infamous Janjaweed. Now, it's very clear that the recruitment, the arming, and the training of the Janjaweed was engineered by the Sudanese government. According to Suleiman Hamid, the genesis of the Janjaweed goes back to the early 1990s, when Hassan Turabi, the leader of the Islamist movement, issued a clear directive stating that the non-Arab groups who are members of the National Islamic Front from Darfur began to defect. Therefore, the National Islamic Front should support the Arab groups to forcibly transfer the four from their home in Jabal Marra to another area and remove their arms. Their land should be given to the Arabic-speaking groups such as Mahriya and so on. Turabi also called for the disarming of the Zaghawa and their transfer to Kordofan, as well as the arming of Arab groups. According to Suleiman Hamid, this what really amounted to a fatwa became the main rationale for the campaign of ethnic cleansing. After a great deal of reluctance, Western European countries, the U.S. and the U.N. finally accepted the fact that what was happening in Darfur is actually a genocide. But describing it as a genocide is one thing, doing something about it is another. The West's main concern in the Sudan is to force the Khartoum government to honor its agreement with the SPLA. Leaning too hard on al-Bashir government, according to this logic, might expose the regime to threats from the hardliners and the security clique that is running the country. Another hurdle to serious action in Darfur is the threat of using veto power by China, Sudan's main oil trading partner and suppliers of arms, as well as the wrangling between the U.S. and European governments over the issue of the persecution of those who committed crimes. This explains why the UN issued a series of watered-down resolutions on Darfur. The UN gave the Sudanese government a series of deadlines to disarm the Janjaweed, but the only stick was the ineffective AU monitors. Experts estimate that a force of upward 44,000 would be needed to secure Darfur. By trying to save the North-South peace deal, the West is ignoring the fact that Sudan has collapsed into a center-periphery conflict that could spill over to the neighboring countries. In addition to Darfur, the rebellion of the Bija people in the northern eastern part of the country is growing in intensity and scale. The regime response was swift and severe. For instance, in January this year, Bija activists organized a peaceful demonstration in the city of Port Sudan. The government responded by sending troops who shot and killed 16 unarmed demonstrators. At the same time, there's potential for arrest in the south itself by local factions and militias that were not part of the deal between the SPLA and the central government. The peace agreement between the government and the SPLA generated unprecedented debate both within and outside the Sudan. Countless conferences, seminars, workshops have been organized, some by the government. The purpose was to promote a dialogue and to break the monopoly of government media and to discuss the most pressing issues facing the country. The accord was hailed by many Sudanese for ending the bloodshed and the destruction that wrecked the South for more than two decades. To some, it represents the beginning of a new chapter that could bring about genuine democratic transformation. However, many have remained skeptical. The most serious flaw of the agreement is the fact that it is a bilateral deal between the SPLA and the military regime that represent a minority of the country's population. The agreement and the power sharing excluded the major northern opposition groups and regional movements such as Darfur, the Bija, and others. Moreover, by framing Sudan's conflict as one between the north and the south, the accord treated the north as a monolithic entity, thereby ignoring the aspiration of marginalized groups there. Most seriously is that the accord asserted that Islam is the system of governance, or should be the basis for the system of governance in the north, thereby determining the fate of this region. Moreover, despite the fact that many of the regime's leaders have blood on their hands and were responsible for some of the worst human rights violations, the agreements do not provide for any kind of accountability or justice. In short, the peace agreement would entrench the power of the Islamist regime and would not lead to a genuine democratic transformation. Since the split of the Islamist movement, the regime lost its legitimating ideology, and there is no clearly defined system of governance. Currently, the country is run by a security clique and a band of army officers and civilians who turn the state institutions into personal fiefdoms for the accumulation of wealth and power. Below them is a group of parasites who use their affiliation with the ruling party to accumulate considerable wealth. Although corruption and favoritism were common under previous regimes in the Sudan and elsewhere in Africa, these practices have reached unparalleled levels under the present Islamist regime. No other place illustrates the emergent social disparities between the nouveau riche and the ordinary folk than the capital city of Khartoum, where opulent suburbs with upscale malls, expensive cars, and European-style mansions have sprung all over the city, while the overwhelming majority of the population live in their rugged mud houses, and millions of refugees and displaced people occupy the shanty towns around the city. There is no reason to assume that the rebellion and violence that erupted in Darfur and elsewhere cannot happen in Khartoum itself. The ruling clique is using ethnicity in yet another unscrupulous way. It is widely believed that the current vice president has filled the security agencies with people from his ethnic group in the north, in the far north. It is reported that in doing so, he was following the model of Saddam Hussein, who recruited the Tikrit people from his region. In other words, ethnic loyalty is much more important than party or ideological loyalty. Now, in the early days of the regime, it's reported that security officers from non-Arab groups in Darfur and Central African Republic were brought to torture political detainees who are Arabic speakers. Now it's the reverse, that these days Arabic-speaking security officers were responsible for executing the war and Darfur, torturing the political prisoners from that region. The strategy of using the North House peace agreement as a template to resolve other conflicts in the Sudan is fraught with danger. The ruling gang will not relinquish power because they have a lot to lose. Their strategy is to use the concessions made in the Nifasha agreement to block any calls for compromises in Darfur, the northeast, or in the to share power with other groups. Darfur rebels, as well as eastern rebels, will attempt to hold out as long as possible, hoping that Western pressure will give them a better deal. It's unclear how Jongerang, who will be in the unique position of Sudan's top vice president, will deal with these issues. Naturally, he will try to secure the terms of the North-South peace deal, which means that he would likely lean on the regional rebel groups to accept any deal. But that does not mean that these rebels will cave. If the government continued to follow its usual response, violence would likely spread throughout the country and also raise the possibility of factional fights within the regime itself. In conclusion, we could say that the horrific violence that afflicted Darfur destroyed the intercommunal relations and caused immeasurable damage to its social fabric. There's an urgent need for action to save lives and to preserve what is left in Darfur and to prevent further turmoils in Africa's largest country. In addition to taking practical steps such as ceasefire, relief, disarming the Janjaweed, and rehabilitations of displaced, there is a need for a genuine reconciliation as well as major political transformation. But reconciliation cannot happen without justice. As in other parts of the world, genocide has a profound imprint on memory. It's an apocalyptic event that can forever alter people's perception of each other. In coming to terms with genocide, we should go beyond formal negotiations on power sharing and so forth, but we need to require also the administration of justice and the persecution of those who were responsible for the killings and so on. Preventing another Darfur requires a comprehensive settlement for all outstanding issues in the Sudan and a genuine democratic transformation, the establishment of a secular, pluralist, and decentralized state, developing a sense of common citizenship among people who differ in their identities, cultures, and religions is a formidable task, but is by no means an impossible one. Very few countries in the world are united by common descent, language, religion, and culture, and the sense that there is one united group of people inhabiting connected territory has had to be constructed. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture presented by Boston University's African Studies Department titled Local Perspectives on the Sudanese Conflict. Speaking tonight was Professor Ahmed Sakanga, former Fulbright Scholar in Morocco and Mellon Fellow at Harvard University. We began with an introduction from James Pritchett, Associate Professor of Anthropology, Director of Boston University's African Studies Center, and Associate Provost for Inter-University Programs. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odette. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.